Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hey everyone. Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Today, I happen to be speaking to Alexis Sikorski. Alexis, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I always say at the start of the podcast, so people can get a little bit of a visual as to where people are in the world. Where are you? Where have you been so kind to speak to me today from?
Outside London, in the UK.
Outside London, and we were talking about the time difference before. It's something I'm sort of really used to now, but I still find it sort of amazing that we can speak across the other side of the world like this. I think it's fantastic. But before we dive into, I guess, like the main part of the podcast, for people who don't know who you are, what you get up to, would you be so kind as to give everyone a bit of an overview, like an annotated sort of history of how you, what you're doing now, how you came to be what you're doing at the moment?
Okay, I'll do the very fast version, and if you need more detail, just let me know. I'll dig into it.
Sure.
Started a software company in Geneva in 2000. My best friend and myself in my basement, and that's the end of the comparison with Apple or any of the big tech company. But it was a small startup, grew the company to roughly 10, 12 million revenue in 15 years. Mm-hmm. 2015, I got a phone call from the private equity guys, which happens every week. And every week you don't pick up the phone. But for some reason, I picked this one up, had a feeling. I don't know why. French people, software guys. So I said, okay, let's talk.
Yep.
And they came and said, want to buy your company? And I said, no, you really don't. Because at the time, we were still recovering from the global financial crisis. So all our clients, literally 100% of our clients were banks. And in 2008, they decided that, well, we're not going to buy anything anymore. So it took us 7 years to recover. So when the company, when they called, the company was, let's say we would have take some creative accounting to call it break even.
Right.
But I was calling it break even at the time. And so I told them, no, but you come back in 2 years and I'll talk to you in 2 years because the company is going to be profitable again. Mm. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to talk right now and you're going to go do a little business plan. You're going to tell me where you're going to be in 2 years. And then we talk. I said, okay, that's a fun exercise anyway. Did the business plan, let's say got creative with my business plan, optimistic, like all business plan, right? It's not lying. It's a business plan. You're not supposed to be realistic.
Yeah.
And they saw my business plan and said, perfect. We're going to buy your company now using the numbers of your business plan. We're going to pay 11 times your EBITDA that you put in your business plan. And we're going to give you 85% cash right now and 15% earnout. And like from this day to the moment the money was actually in my account, I was sure it was a friend doing a hoax or something like that. But they literally made me an offer you can't refuse. So I took the money laughing and say like, these guys are absolutely nuts. So took the money, committed to stay for an extra 2 years. To get my potential earnout, which obviously I was certain I was never going to make. And with the help of these guys, the company would almost did double what we had in our little business plan. So I end up making more money on the earnout that I made on the actual exit. And that was 2017. I remained at CEO till 2020. And at that point, we made a huge acquisition of a company that was bigger than us. And I noticed the guy who was running this company, the CEO of this company that we hired as our head of sales, were actually so much better than I was as a CEO. Mm. Like the guy has all the experience of international big group. He was 10 years older than me. He spoke Swiss German, which in Switzerland is important, and I don't, thank God. And I went to see the PE and say, this guy should be CEO, not me. Also came a time to my life when I was starting to get tired, like it's been 20 years of grinding. So I stayed for an extra year as a chairman, best year of my life. Like if you want the ideal job, it's chairman of a company. That's really, really the good job. They pay you full salary and you literally do nothing. And seriously, like they were paying the same salary that I was getting for 16 hours of work per day for a morning meeting per month. It's fantastic. I want that job back. And in 2020 or 2021, I sold the remaining of my shares because like I had enough and they made me a super nice offer. So I sold the shares to them. And then that's it. Moved to England. A year, maybe 18 months later, they sold the company for 160 million. So.
And so your consultancy now, like, how closely aligned is the sort of work that you, or the sort of things you talk to people about? Like outside of obviously your book, you know, that we'll talk about too, which is, you know, this, that whole experience, I mean, that sounds like, you know, it's a remarkable thing to happen. It's probably not something that you could ever have imagined was going to happen, right? You know?
Not.
Yeah, it was the most random thing that could have happened. It's like, yeah, I mean, it's probably a pretty natural thing for most people to go, oh, really? Is this a joke? Is it a, you know, it's so out of the blue. But it obviously had a really big impact on you. So in your consultancy now, like it sounds like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sort of sounds like that. Obviously, that whole experience was huge, and was that essentially the driving force behind then, like what you're doing now to help other people to be able to bridge that kind of gap between. You know, is to sort of see the potential that these sort of seemingly random things can actually have a real benefit?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First of all, I don't like my job. It's not really a job, but I don't like what I do right now to be referred as consultancy.
Right.
Because consultant, you expect they will actually do something, like produce PDFs and PowerPoint, and that's not what I do. I only work with CEOs and founders. I don't work with anybody else in the company. And my job is to sit with them and help them. Mm. I've been called by a client and I like the idea of the CEO whisperer. So yeah. I'm not a consultant in the sense that you'll never see a PowerPoint from me or a PDF.
But it's still a sort of a handy word, isn't it? Because that's what you, yeah, it's still, I'm descriptive, but I know what you mean though. Yeah, is that sometimes it's not really apt. It's like it's not 100%.
I think mentorship better, to be honest.
Yeah. You should.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because I'm sort of branding myself, like it's, words are powerful, right? Like, you know, words are actually important for things, but you also have the point where you use a word because most people generally know what it means.
Yeah.
You know, they go, okay, it means I consult. But if you call yourself, if you go, I'm a CEO whisperer, you know, whilst it's actually kind of good, like I like that. But at the same time, some people might go, I'm not sure what that means yet until enough people use it.
And it sounds a bit dodgy as well. It sounds like behind the curtain.
Good, yeah.
And mentorship sounds so pretentious, like pay me, I'll be your mentor. You know what I mean? It sounds like, I don't know.
Yeah, it does. It can, it, it has the, I guess it's history too. Whilst once again, it's also descriptive. It's like going, I'm a coach, I'm a mentor. But when you're speaking to the CEO of some huge company who's super experienced, then what is your role? And that's probably a good segue too, then into, I guess, just revisiting that question that I had about like the inspiration that you then had, like from that whole experience to start doing what you're doing now. Were there some key realizations? Because I find it kind of fascinating that someone, and so maybe you can expand on this a little bit, but that somebody obviously saw something very specific, either in you and the company, despite you going, no, I really don't think you want to buy it. They obviously saw something really specific in it, right? Like, or either in the company and or you to want to do that. And that was then the impetus for you to then go, you know, do this sort of plan and think about it differently. So is those like sorts of things or some of those topics, you know, things that you feel or do you find you're discussing them with people that you're helping go, oh, like, hey, like maybe private equity is a good option for you?
Yeah. So first of all, I thought at the time that it was completely random or specific, but with the knowledge I have now, I realize it's actually is not. It's a deal where the amount of information is not equal. Why is it a good deal for them and why is it a good deal for me? Is they know something I don't know. What I don't know because I cannot know is what they are bringing to the deal, right? Mm.
Yeah.
So I make a business plan based on what I bring to the table, which is normal because I don't have more information. So they take that and they say, okay, I can imagine what went through their mind very clearly. And I actually know now because this guy is actually a good friend of mine since. So we talked and he explained that to me and he's interviewed in my book. So we are pretty close. And he said, look, I see the business plan and I know it's 50% optimistic, right? Because these guys are not idiots. They've seen thousands of companies. So they discount 50% of the value of say, okay, in my, I was doing zero EBITDA and in my business plan, I think I said I'm going to do 2.5 million EBITDA in 2 years. And they probably went, so, okay, these guys can do 1.5 million on his own. He said 2.5, but he can probably do 1.5 million. But we can do an extra 2 million. And that he doesn't know. And that I didn't know at the time. So no, it's not something specific. It's actually how private equity make good deal is they know what they bring to the table and the seller doesn't know what they bring to the table. So that's something I learned and that's something I'm helping my clients. I'd say, okay, when you do your business plan, take into account what the private equity will bring to you. And the biggest thing is, of course, they have knowledge. Of course, they have networks, but they have cash. Mm. So they can do M&A. So that's what they did. And the reason they brought the company from, don't remember, maybe a 30 million valuation to 160 million valuation is mainly by M&A. Mm. Right. And so no, it's not specific. So the reason I decided to start doing that is actually I started an executive MBA in Oxford, mainly because I was bored and like I had time and I had a bit of money. So I started an executive MBA. And in the executive MBA, I met lots of entrepreneurs because I'd say a good 25% are either entrepreneur or wannabe entrepreneurs. And started talking to this guy and say, hey, you know what? Actually, I can help them because there's lots of stuff I know they don't know. So I started helping and I said, well, that's a neat thing to do, actually, helping entrepreneurs. It's interesting people. It's a nice thing to do. And yeah, been there, done that. And you have so many people who try to help, but that actually never been there, never done it. Like, so that's why I decided to do that.
Yeah, that's actually, it's a thing that crops up all the time, not all the time, but like a fair bit when I'm sort of speaking to different people who are either, you know, business coaches, whatever you want, and whatever term you want to to call, but like the experience, the real world experience, you can't really put a price on it, can you? Like that's you know, the things, the little sort of nuances of, you know, I guess especially not just like business deals, but dealing with people, you know, that's like that big skill that's, it's very hard to quantify, and you can't go like there's a, you know, there's like a measurement on, you know, on that kind of experience. But when you started to meet, like you were saying before, meet some of those other people, it's interesting too, because those, it sounded like you didn't have like this sort of urge before then to go out and start to, you know, do those particular things, but it was being around those people that you realized that, and that there was
this, a good person.
Yeah, it's but it is kind of exciting, and generally, I mean, it sounds overly simplistic, but I think it's true. Like, it's actually just nice to be able to then see other people succeed, and then obviously like it becomes very apparent. You know, it's easy for you in sort of retrospect, or for anyone that's done a bunch of stuff that other people haven't done, it's like super clear, you know, and somebody mentions, it's like, oh, I don't know how to, like, what's this about, this part of private equity? And for you, you've been there and you've had the conversations and you've done all these things. So now at this particular point, like through this journey, what was the point that you decided it would be a good idea to write the book, which is called Cashing Out, right?
Yeah. So yeah. And that's going to sound super new agey, and I apologize for that. But I realized that, well, I think I always knew, but that helping people is actually a value in itself. Makes you feel so good when you help somebody succeed, and they actually succeed, regardless of the financial value of it. I do a lot of pro bono job, but less and less, because if people don't pay, they don't listen. I realize that. So like, and then I realized, okay, even if I will work, if I go back to working 16 hours a day, which I'm not doing and which I will never do ever again, like that's, this part is specifically for my wife, and I would only be able to help a handful of people every year, because it takes time. So I said, like, how do I help more people? And the book is all that. It's like, how do you help more people?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just a practical thing, right? Yeah. It's just a quicker way to get information out there. But yeah, I mean, sort of saying, I think there's also value too. Like it is very easy to go, oh, you know, it sort of sounds a bit, you know, woo woo, a bit this or that. But I think the reality is too that outside of just the fact that it might make you or I feel good, I think the fact is too that when you help people, it actually makes whatever that industry is or that little bit better. It makes like somebody else be a bit better informed, and like you don't necessarily know the flow on effects of it, but it might make them a bit more informed and might make them have a slightly better opinion of somebody else because they're better informed. Like all these little things that flow into like the bigger picture, which I often think about it like that, because, you know, it's sort of about communication, a lot of it. And that if people are better equipped, then I mean, it's no guarantee that people won't do things that they shouldn't do, obviously. You know, but it's still, it helps too. So, so when did you actually write the book?
I started, I think a year and a half ago, took a year to write, give or take.
Yeah.
And then took 6 months to launch, because launching a book has become a very like algorithmic thing. If you know what I mean, you need to know how Amazon works to successfully launch a book.
Right.
So
right,
a big learning curve like that, because I wanted the book to actually be read. So tell that to your listeners. Do not write a book hoping you're going to make money out of it, because it costs way more than it makes.
It's very popular. It's very popular right now. Everyone wants to write a book.
Yeah, but it's not. Unless you're like a novelist or you're super famous, it's really hard to make any kind of money writing a book.
But
it's so rewarding. Like, it's hard to explain. Today, I had a meeting with a 30-year-old girl who's a postdoc in Oxford, and she was talking to me, getting help on how to spin off her new drug that's going to cure cancer. Like, you don't get access to people like that in regular life. And I was like, she came for my advice, but basically I was listening to her for an hour and a half because it's so exciting. And yeah, I have no idea how to help her, but I'll find a way because it's so exciting. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. But the opportunities, I guess, there, right? Like, is opening doors. Because then it's not only like the process, like say when you were writing the book, what or did you have any particular realizations about things that were surprising? Because I guess like a lot of people might view, like I haven't written the book, but I would imagine, but I'm some relatives who are novelists and stuff. And often, you know, that's some fiction. So, but when you're writing about what, say you already know, and you're writing about things that you want to, you know, be helpful to other people, did you have any particular, you know, thing or things that came up when you were writing that you went, oh, wow, like I didn't realize that, like that the actual process of writing brought up, like in your mind that you went, oh, that's interesting, like something that you hadn't thought of before. Did anything like that happen?
Yeah, a lot, actually. First of all, I realized one thing is people love to be interviewed for books. So that's a fantastic way to get people talk honestly about their job. Like I've had meeting with 500 private equity people all my life, and there is always a hidden agenda, right? So they never be completely open and honest. And when you call them and say, I want to interview you for my books, and I want to tell me the reality of that particular aspect of your job, they actually open up like a book. They love telling about their job. They love talking to you. So that's like, it's very strong knowledge for my next book. And the other thing that surprised me is how many people will tell me, oh, don't do that because you're giving away your secrets. That's completely like, can I swear on your podcast?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Like I keep telling ideas are like assholes. Everybody has one, right? So like it's execution that matters. Like, yes, I'm giving, I didn't hide anything. Like everything I know is in that book pretty much. And I don't think that's going to cost me business. And I don't think like people are say, oh, now I have everything. I completely downloaded this guy. I don't need to talk to him. And he's like, he gave me all the keys. It's not how it works. It's not how life works. So that was like, I was surprised by people telling me, oh, don't write the book. Like you're going to give away everything.
Oh, was that? Oh, I understand. Yeah, right. Yeah, I always find that funny because that to me, it sort of implies it feels like a really ego-driven thing there too. It's like, wow, what you have to say might be super valuable. Yeah, for sure. But is it like so valuable or are you saying it in such a way that no one will like ever want to talk to you? And if that is the case, they're probably not your clients. You know, they're probably not going to be, not the right person to talk to you.
And you know what? Like I always have a big imposter syndrome, right? Like, do I bring enough value for the people to buy the book? And then I actually did a little mental math, right? The ebook on Amazon is like $4.99. Am I bringing $4.99 of value? I definitely am. So that's how I fight the imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
But do I have to consider, is it worth $4.99? Yeah, it is. So I have no problem with that.
Yeah. And then it's worth even more if they read it like 10 times as the then like $40, you know, or like $50 or whatever.
Yeah. And they can give it to their friends for free. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Share it around. But that's the great thing. I mean, I like anything. And I've if I reflect on it, it's probably because I've been talking to so many people on the podcast who've been writing books. Like it's been like quite a lot of people. I mean, you included, like people who are wanting to share, because it's my job. You know, I see my job on the podcast is to help people share things they want to talk about. That's my job. Like, so a lot of people are talking about their book, and I've been more and more sort of interested, not necessarily yet about writing my own book, because I don't feel like I have anything to write about yet. But at the same time, I'm always like, wow, that's, I know it would be incredibly hard because I sort of speak to writers and other people, but like that's why I asked that question before about, did you have any particular realizations? Because I keep imagining that would be, for me, if I was to do it, something that would happen a lot, that I would be just through the process of having to reflect on things like proactively, because you want somebody to read it and understand it and you want it to be good, you're putting a particular sort of focus on it, right?
It definitely helped me getting better in my job.
Really?
The book. Yeah, 100%, because I didn't learn any skill that I didn't know, but just organizing your thoughts. And I wanted to organize it as a methodology with steps. And that actually now when I meet with clients, it's helped me structure my thoughts, right? There are steps in what I do is I take a company that's not there yet and bring it to 100 million exits. That's my brand, right? It's what I do. I take a company that does 5 million revenue and bring it to 100 million exit. So there are steps to do that. You have like, I don't stick to a methodology because it's not my personality, but it's a guideline, right? So have I properly assessed the company? Like, do I know everything I need to know about this company? And does the CEO knows everything he needs to know? Does the founder? And usually the answer to that is no. I can tell you, like, in 100% of the case, the people I talk to don't know enough about their company. And one example is they don't know their numbers. They never do. Like, that's the first thing is know your numbers. And it's a skill. They need tools and they usually don't have them. If you talk to the 20 million company, they have them. The 5 million company, they don't have them. because it's usually not in their priorities, because companies are not founded by CFOs. Well, some are, but it's very rare. They are created either by tech people or by salespeople. And these guys, they don't have the expertise. And lots of them, that's just an example, but lots of them get their numbers once per year or twice per year. And I keep telling them it's like piloting a plane without a GPS. So at the end of the year, you say, oh, but I spend way too much on that thing. It's too late, my friend. You're already 100 miles past the airport. It's too late. There's no coming back. So all that kind of stuff, right? There is a methodology. What's your plan? Like, I do not come if the plan to get to 100 million is more than 3 years, because I don't believe in plans that are more than 3 years. The market has a sense of humor, like the life has a sense of humor. So if you do your 10-year plans, they never work. So is there a path to get you to 100 million in 3 years? If the answer is no, I usually don't come. Do the guy actually want that? Because you cannot force it on someone. Like, half of the business of the world are our lifestyle business, and it's perfectly fine. And I love our lifestyle business, but that's not what I do. I don't bring value, because lifestyle business is all about cost cutting and tax optimization, basically. And how do you get your your Range Rover in the name of the company, so you don't have to pay taxes. That's what a lifestyle business is. And I'm not good at that. You have people that are much better than I am. So All this step of assessing the founder, assessing the company, does the guy has a number? Is 100 million a right number? 100 million is a good number because it's basically universal number that you can afford to never work an extra day of your life if you don't want to. And it takes that kind of number. People who think they can do that with 5 or 10 million, they're wrong. It takes more money than that. Because like you want to leave capital to your kids and you want to avoid paying and you have the tax and et cetera. So all that stuff, the assessment part is super important. And then what's your plan? Like we're going to put a plan together to get you to that number. And it's tricky because there's lots of stuff involved, like what's your marketing plan? What's your business plan? What's your M&A plan? I'm a big, big, big fan of M&A. So what are you buying in the next 2 years to help double your growth? And then when you have your plan, how are you going to execute it? Like so many people have a great plan, but fail to execute. And when you're done executing your plan, when you get a year from getting your number, now you start the sales process and they have no experience. And it's, again, there are steps. Like I call it the first step. I call it dressing the bride. How do you get your company look sexy to a private equity? How do you do a deck? How do you talk to these people? What's your valuation? What's your nominal EBITDA, et cetera, et cetera. So the book may be better in a sense that it structured my approach pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. So have you also had, say you've been working with somebody and they've begun this process and they end up through the process of their business actually being so well structured and so well organized and done everything right that they actually don't want to sell their business then?
No, I haven't had that. it's very, very difficult for, the entrepreneur I work with are not Elon Musk, right? They're not billionaires at that point. And having gone through that process, I know how taxing it is, how demanding it is, how lonely it is to be an entrepreneur. So usually when they get to the point where they can actually exit for a number that's good for them, it's very, very hard to say no to 100 million.
I never had one.
But to be honest, I'm not yet to the point where I actually made 100 million exit for my clients. We're getting there. And one is, well, my biggest client, I'd say, is 1 year away from the 100 million exit. And now he's actually pushing me to do a lower exit. Said, listen, like, why don't we do a 50 million exit now? So I'm working on that.
Right. Right. Yeah. I would imagine. I mean, I guess I only asked that too, because as you were talking, I was thinking doing all these particular things, I guess like you writing the book, like you ended up having certain realizations happen because you were writing the book, because somebody is going to sell their business. They, you know, are thinking about their business perhaps differently with your, you know, help then too, than they would otherwise think about it, which might mean like things are restructured, that, you know, are structured better. The marketing's better. All these things are better. And then I thought, well, maybe like there's a scenario, as I was running through scenarios in my head, I was thinking maybe there's a scenario where somebody is like, wow, it's so good. It's so good that I'll like hang on to it. But then, you brought that up and I was like, well, yeah. I mean, like if there's a chance for somebody to do that and then, actually, I guess that's like a segue to how many people that you've sort of spoken with or been working with have you found actually also like as a part of wanting to sell their business, they're using that as a facility really to pursue like some really specific other project that the reason for doing it outside of just being able to make that much money out of it is also because they want to have the freedom to actually do a really particular, you know, sort of project that isn't the business. It's like something charity. Else.
Charity. I have one client who wants to change the world. he has a specific area where he wants to help, and he thinks he needs $100 million to have an impact on that particular topic. It's big. It's third world solutions, so it's expensive. And he said, like, I need $100 million to change the world, to make the world a better place. So I very strongly respect that. This one I want to help, like, more. Like, yeah, more than the guy who wants his yacht. Like, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, I get that, you know, someone going, I want to be able to sell the business and make a lot of money. That's on one hand, that's its own thing. That's like, yeah, I like money, and it's going to be able to set me up for the rest of my life, et cetera. But in my mind, I guess because I've, you know, like a lot of people, you have different private projects and things you'd like to pursue. And, you know, it popped into my mind that I thought, I would imagine there would be like a lot of people who want that, you know, larger figure for a very specific reason, you know, for that, like something like you were saying.
Yeah, and there is another, like, very common is people, when they get to that point, are usually around my age, like in their 50s or even in their 60s. Mm. And their main goal is to be sure their kids are taken care of.
Yeah.
Like, it's a hard world out there. Like, yeah. I have 3.5 kids, and, like, obviously I have 3 and 1 on the way. So obviously, like, my big boys are 23 and 21, and one is doing I forget how it's called, just before the doctorate in the US and quantitative analysis. So he's an engineer. So this one is, I'm sure he's set up. The other one is studying hospitality, so he's going to be good as well. But, like, how do I guarantee they never have to work a day of their life if they don't want to? Mm. How do I guarantee that their kids actually will be able to afford a good education, et cetera, et cetera? So, like, yeah, that's a main driver for a lot of people, to be sure their kids are okay.
Well, that's right. I mean, I resonate with that. Like, I feel the same with my little boy who's not – I'm little anymore. He's like 15 or – almost 15, but yeah, it's very normal for parents to want to do that. And then if you have an opportunity to do that, and then still there's that whole like the money, business, entrepreneurship, and family and life, they're all, you know, for most people, they're tightly integrated, really, aren't they? Like, they're one and the same. It's like,
well, especially if you're an entrepreneur, you navigate in a risky environment. Mm. Like, you know, shit happens, and lots of entrepreneurs are asset rich but cash poor. That was my case before I sold the company. Like, in 2008, like after 2008, everything I owned was in the company. My house was mortgaged, and so I had a company that have a theoretical value, but you don't pay for your kids' school fees with theoretical value. They want hard cash, so that's a big motivator. And the one I'm yet to meet and I'm looking forward to is a bit different to what you said, but along the same lines, is the guy who has a company that when I come in has a 20 million valuation, and in 3 years I bring him to a 100 million valuation, then he's going to ask me, okay, how many more years to get it to a billion?
Right.
That's this one I'm waiting for, and it's going to happen at some point. Like, when you see that in 2 years or 2.5 years, you go to 100 million valuation, it's easy to think, like, how many years before you get to a billion.
Yeah. Is that, have you had any taste of whether that relates specifically to a particular personality type or a type of person? Like, as in, or whether that would be, I mean, there's probably a little bit of both. This is a pretty open-ended question, but, like, whether it's you know, a product of circumstance, like somebody then sees a little bit, like what I was saying before about somebody going, oh, actually I like the business so much because it's like it's so great now because, you know, I've had all this sort of assistance, I'm going to hang on to it. But then their goals change And then they are like, oh, well, maybe I could do this now and maybe sell it then, or maybe never sell it. You know, then at that point, the profit that they're making from it and they're able to achieve, like if that's then linked to, like what we were saying before, linked to other specific goals, like for that money in some way.
Yeah, that could happen. But remember something, if we're talking a growth business and not a lifestyle business, one of the absolute rule I put in place with my client, and he has to agree with that, is as long as I'm working with him, he doesn't distribute dividends. Because that's my ammunition to grow the company. If he starts taking money out of the company, I'm out. Yeah. It's that simple. Because then if he uses my ammunition to pay for his yacht, I'm out. Then it becomes a lifestyle business. So perfect, run your lifestyle business, but I'm out. That's not what I do. So for the 2-3 years that the guy is working with me, he doesn't see any money. He gets his salary. Yeah. I let him give himself a very high salary. I'm fine with that. I don't care about operational costs. So I'm fine with that, but no dividends.
Yeah, but that's the goal then, isn't it? That's like, you know, you have to be able to do that to achieve the goal.
And that's a conversation from like meeting number one or meeting number two. Do you realize that we're going to grow your company from 2 million EBITDA to 20 million EBITDA and you're not going to see a penny of this growth, you personally? You're going to see all the money at exit, but before that, you're not going to see a penny. You're going to see salary increase, but you're not going to see dividends.
It's like the chef that's making the meal for the banquet and they keep on having little samples of it the whole time. They're having them, you know, have a taste of
That's not how it works. So like maybe at some point I'll meet somebody who said, okay, now we are 100 million valuation. That means we make 10 million EBITDA. I actually don't want to sell. I want to continue taking my 10 millions per year. But it's not a good strategy, right? Because even if you take your 10 million per year, then you have no more growth, right? Because you have no ammunition. You have no war chest. You don't know how you're going to survive the shit happens situation. And 100 million cash will bring you 5 million per year with zero risk, right? So why would you risk everything to get 10 million per year instead of getting 5 million per year with zero risk?
With the war chest idea and you know, risk, I'm just generally, how many people do you come across who sort of push back on the need on that idea that, you know, to manage risk in that sort of way, to be like well prepared, you know, who go, there's no real need, I'm obviously making, you know, this much money, there's no need to do that, that's like overkill. How many people do you come across who think like that?
All of them. All of them, and all of them have to change their mind in conversation number one or number two. And the question is, what's your war chest? How many months of burn rate do you have in your bank account? The answer is usually close to zero, and I want to bring them to 12 months. So that's one of the things they have to sign on the beginning. Like, one of the number one goals is you have a war chest, because global financial crisis will happen again. Like climate change will destroy your factory. Like how you're going to survive these moments. Also, I need ammunition to make you grow. So your war chest is what you can invest in a new company. So like that, all of them need to understand that. And they usually do pretty easily because it's common sense, but it's not something like lots of the people I talk to have not thought about an exit. They don't think about growth. They only think about organic growth. They don't think M&A because they're too small. They think they're too small to think M&A. They're 100% wrong. But like one of the first questions I get is, how big do I need to be to acquire a company? And I said, that's the wrong question. Is the only question is what your war chest and what can you afford? But if you do 100,000 per year of revenue, buy a company that does 100,000 per year and you doubled your company. And that costs you $1 million. That means you need to have 200,000 in your war chest and the rest you can leverage. It's stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
It's common sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's all, you know, or at least a part of it is almost like a numbers game, really, isn't it? You know, it's like you get, you know, to some extent, you know, there's like you've got X amount here, you can spend this on here if you, you know, but then I guess the other factors then too, like how do you, I guess, trying to frame the question the right way, like when somebody goes, or if they've got a preconceived idea about private equity, right? And they're like, oh, that means that, you know, like people have different perceptions. They go, oh, it's dodgy. I don't know if they're going to rip me off. I don't know this. I don't know that. How do you, I guess, speak to people about the potential for that? Like they get, obviously, that they will reach a certain point, I guess, in your relationship with them that they understand that you're doing these things to help them grow to reach this goal. But at what point do people, or do you find that people like have, it's hard for them to get past the idea of that, you know, how private equity is going to help? I mean, it's kind of obvious they get funds and then they grow, but like, what does that mean for them? Are they the right thing for it? Like, how do you make that match between the business and the private equity people? Like, where's the match come in?
Again, I'm so sorry to give always the same answer to all your questions, but again, it's number one on number two conversation. Explain to them what is private equity, how private equity operates. Why aren't they going to fuck you up? Because it's not in their, like, if it was in their financial interest to fuck you up, they would. No question, but it's not. Your goals and their goals are aligned. They both want to grow the company. You both make money if they grow the company. They do not want to change management unless they have to. They still have to in about 40% of the deal. So don't fool yourself. You'll have to still be good because they can change you. They can fire you and they will if you don't deliver. But if you deliver, they hate changing management because that's not what they do. They don't manage company, they finance company. So they hate having to fire you, but if you're not good, they're going to fire you. If you don't deliver, they're going to fire you. But you know what? Without the private equity, if you don't deliver, you're going to go bankrupt. At least with the private equity, you got some cash up front. Now you own 20% of the company, so they can fire you, but you have 80 million in your bank account that they cannot take back. If you don't take the private equity, then if your company goes bankrupt, you have zero in your bank account. So you actually, when you sell to private equity, you're de-risking massively because you get cash in your bank account.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of stuff I tell them.
Yeah. No, and that makes sense. I mean, I guess I asked the question in probably a slightly different way too, because I haven't been through that experience myself, but you know, having bought like another business, you know, in order to grow ours, it was great. Like it seemed like, you know, it's, you know, a slightly different scenario, but it seemed like a big risk at the time. But it's like, you know, I guess there's a lot of things where you don't have any experience doing something. And when you first do it, like the very first time, there's probably very few people or very few times where people won't feel that that's risky, you know, for some.
It is risky.
Yeah, because and you don't also, know X, you don't know X, you don't know Y. And
yeah, but you have ways to know. And that's a big part of my methodology as well. First of all, private equity get a bad rap. There's no question. And for the same reason, pretty much any market gets a bad rap because a few like bad apples, and that's the one that being discussed, obviously. And I always tell my client, you're going to do a massive due diligence on your private equity. Mm. And private equity are fine with that. Like they do a massive due diligence on you. Like get ready. It's going to be painful. I call that the 6 months colonoscopy, the due diligence part. And I say, but you're going to do the same with them. And they're totally fine with it. And I even tell them how they're going to do that. There is one thing you want to avoid. Well, there's many things you want to avoid, but one of the main technique the bad PE use, it's called fish and chip. A client of mine gave me this expression. I love it. They fish you with a very high number in a letter of intent. And then during the due diligence, they chip away on that number. So they say, we're going to buy your company 100 million. You signed a letter of intent at 100 million. And letter of intent is a very powerful mental tool because you really think you have a deal because you have something signed on paper, but you have nothing. The letter of intent is non-binding, neither for them or for you. So you basically have nothing except a guy that tells you, I'm interested. And that's the valuation I think is reasonable. So 90% of private equity will end up closing around the number on the LOI. But you have like the bad apples who's going to try to chip at that number. And when they do that, it's known. So first thing I said, so you're going to due deal your private equity. Well, often it's people I know. So the no due diligence is required because I know the guys. But if I don't know them, I even tell them how you do your due diligence. You talk to the people they bought. So you call your private equity, you being super honest with them. You said, I'm going to do a due diligence on you now to see if you're a cheap fish and chip guy or not. So please give me the name of five clients that you acquired. And they will give it to you. No problem. You're never going to call these people, obviously. And you're going to call all the other ones. And it's very easy. They advertise the companies they buy. And people, again, people love to talk. Find the guy that's been acquired on LinkedIn that is not on their website, that they didn't give you as a number, and call him. Say, hey, you've been acquired by private equity X. How did it go? Mm-hmm. And if the guy got fucked, he's going to tell you. Yeah. He's going to be happy telling you. So that's like, yes, it is a risk, obviously. But again, don't forget at the end of the day, your risk is on 20% of the amount, right? Is on what you keep as shares. The money that's in your bank account is never getting out of your bank account unless you remarry, but that's another question. But the private equity cannot get its money back, right? So the only thing they can do to you is fire you. And the only risk you have is you don't get your earn out or you don't get the value on the remaining of your shares. But it's not such a risk, like you already have 80 million in your bank accounts. So
yeah. It's a perception. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things which really come down to under perception of something, right? Perception of risk, or there's like the difference between like actual risk and the perception of risk, or the perception of, you know, of I'm like a lot of things, but you know, once again, like a lot of things, you don't actually know until you're actually in the thick of it and you're, yeah. But like the, you know, it's do you speak to people about the, like the point at which, the benefits outweigh the risk? Does anyone like have that as a big deal that they talk to you about? They go, oh, but you know, this, you know, that feels like I heard some friend who, you know, this happened to them. Yeah. And then you have to count or like how easy these days, like this is like a similar version, I suppose, of what we've already been talking about, but like how much easier is it for you these days speaking to people? Like how quickly do people get that the risk is, you know, is really not worth focusing on, yeah, in terms of like the benefits. People are all in, you know, and they're
well, I tell them that their friends didn't have me because I'm not going to let my clients getting fucked.
That's right.
That's kind of my job, right? So
yeah, like, that's
experience.
Yeah.
I know the guys. I explain the risk because the perceived risk is like, the conversation I have very often at the beginning say, oh yeah, but if I sell to a private equity, how do I keep control of my company? Well, you don't, buddy. You sold. It's not your company anymore. Like you have to be realistic. You cannot like, how do you say in English? Have your cake and eat it or something like that?
Yeah. Have like, your cake and eat it too. Yeah.
Yeah. You sold, my friend. You're not in control of your company. You're now an employee. That's yeah. some they need to realize. You own 20% of the company. If you operate well as your job as a CEO, this 20% is going to end up worth more than the 80% you sell. But you're now an employee of the private equity. You need to realize that.
Isn't that interesting? That's funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, that's a really – that to me, like that's really obvious. But, yeah, it just occurred to me that I guess people would probably like have – even though, I mean, they just – it's like going – I just like sold my car to the guy up the road. Is it okay if I go and like drive the car every now and again?
Keep driving, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're like, and no.
No, you sold the damn thing. And there is another one that's really big. Oh, but will the guy fire all my friends? And the answer is, yeah, they probably will. They probably will. And you know what? You're going to probably fire your friends before you sell to private equity. Because the fact that they are your friends doesn't make them a player, doesn't make them the right man for the job. And you might not fire them, but you might relocate them. And that's like so common, right? The cousin who's the CFO, right? Because you're right now a 5 million company. You don't need a proper CFO. This guy's not going to be the CFO when you reach a point where you're going to sell for 100 million because he doesn't have the skills to do that. So maybe he'll work somewhere else in the company. But, oh, will they fire my cousin? No, because you'll fire him before. You need A players. One of the things I do, and that's also in my book, is like you need A players at every position. So how do we get there? And what do we do with the B and C players you have now? It's you have to be realistic. Like, but the big one is how do I keep the control of my company? You don't. Like, you're an employee. You're like, live with that. Are you okay with that? If not, you don't sell, because if you sell, you don't own. You work for them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. It never really occurred to me that people would have that perspective, because it sounds like
obvious.
Like sold it. Yeah. Yeah. But that's obvious that would, I would imagine that's sort of closely linked to the fact, you know, that they've been spending all this time and energy and years probably running their business. And then all of a sudden, there's a scenario where they don't have that anymore in probably a relatively short amount of time. And the whole paradigm, like it all seems the same because they're still running the business or they are, you know, they're still in the same sort of.
It's still the CEO.
Yeah. Yeah. They're still the CEO, but they're not the CEO. They're an employee. But they are.
But they're like, no, they are. They're an employee and they are the CEO. Most CEOs in the company are employees. Like the Fortune 500 CEOs don't own the company. They're an employee of the company. And if they're not good at their job, they get fired. Like they fired Sam Altman from OpenAI for 3 days. But still, like you're a CEO, you can be fired by the board any day. It's like you're now an employee. So people tend to confuse. Actually, it's confusing because of VC. VC make that confusing, right? Because if you need money to grow, then you will onboard a VC who will take a minority share of your company. And then how do I keep control is a very valid question. Because you can. Mm. You can onboard a VC for a few millions because you need the money to grow. I hope you won't if you're my client, but you can. And you can do that and still keep the control of the company by contract, by not giving them the majority, by not accepting any of the clause they want to add that remove you from control, because at that point you still want the control. But when it's PE, it's out. Like the difference between PE and strategic, which is being acquired by another company, is at least you keep your job for a minute. If you're acquired by another company, you're out. So like on that day, not only you don't have control of the company, but you don't have a job anymore. That's why I'm leaning most of my clients toward PE rather than strategic. And the only time I would talk strategic, if the guy said, listen, I'm out, I'm tired, I want out, then it's not PE, then it's strategic. PE hates a CEO who said, I want out. Because it's a major unknown, right? And they don't like unknown. So,
oh, well, that's risk then, isn't it, too? Yeah, it's like, you know, if you don't know when somebody's going to, you know, somebody's on the edge, or they're not going to be a part of a team. Yeah. Now, like in any team, if like you're in a sporting team and someone was like, oh, I don't really have my heart in it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, that's like even.
It's very interesting. So the usually the PE, when they acquire a company, they try to lock in the key employees. So they did that with most of my C-level guys, and not only C-levels, a few below C-levels. They went to see them and say, listen, you're going to get $5 million out of this deal. I would like you to put $1 million back in the company. And I would like you to have a non-compete clause for a year that you cannot leave and get to work for a competitor in the next year. So they would do that, and they would introduce the concept of good leaver, bad leaver. So we can fire you, but you cannot leave, basically. And they didn't put that in place with me. They say, you don't get a bad leaver clause. You leave whenever you want. And when you leave, you can either keep your shares or sell them. We don't care. And like a couple of years later, I asked the guy, I said, why didn't you put a bad leaver clause? He said, because for us, it's worse to have a CEO that's not invested, that do not have the CEO at all. Like, you can force an employee to stay. You cannot force the CEO to stay if he wants to leave. So they didn't. I was surprised. That was one of the big surprises in the deal, that they did put a bad leaver clause for me.
That's where the people skills come in too, isn't it? Like, is that, you know, I guess somebody not, I mean, knowing those people, but it's, you know, I guess where people get some sort of sense of the sort of person you are, because like perhaps, I don't know the situation, but like perhaps if you were a different sort of person, they may not have done that. Like if they had a sense of you being a certain sort of person, you know, and maybe that's where the people skills come in.
Maybe, and it's interesting. So they didn't put a bad leaver clause for me, but they tripled my salary.
Right.
In Switzerland, it's not common to give big bonuses. Like salaries are high, and you get 10% of your salary at the end of the year. I got 100% bonus every year, and so did my key guys, because they say, again, operational costs, they don't care, but they're here for growth. So operational costs, they don't care. So they pay super high salaries. They treat people super well because it's in their interest. When I chairman myself, so basically I went from running the company to a kind of an honorary job, if you want to be honest. They kept me at the same salary. They said, you know what? I don't want to rock the boat. I don't care about operational costs. You keep your salary. And you come to one meeting per month. I say, yes, sir. Best job of my life.
Yeah, and there's it's a really interesting journey too, because like, you know, sort of hearing it, a lot of these things, like outside of all the numbers and the figures and everything, like is all these things then boiled down at the end of the day to the personal relationships you have with other people and like what people, you know, sort of aiming for, and if everyone's on the same ship, you know, steering the same ship and in the right way, it feels right too. I mean, that sounds that's a bit sort of, you know, woo-woo, but
La La Land, but it's still fundamentally true. Like,
but it is true.
Aligned.
Yeah, because whilst you can't, you're not gonna, you know, sign any deals off necessarily how you feel about things, it certainly is a factor. Like in that, you know, it's not the defining factor, but it is a factor, you know.
I actually do prep my client to talk to PE, because I know what they like with a CEO and I know what they don't like. And the client that I'm going to sell right now, it's a massive prep, because the guy is amazing. He's brilliant, but he ticks a lot of the box that the CEOs don't like. And I'm prepping him very big example. One of the first questions they're going to ask a founder is, why do you want to sell? Like, that's a very, very important question for them, and you have to give the right answer. And they hate if you say, oh, I want to sell because I'm tired, or I want to sell because a lot of, oh, I want to sell because I want to pursue other project. Bad answers. Like they want you. They're buying you. They're buying your company, not a company. Like they're buying you. So everything that gives them the impression that you're going to leave, they don't like. Good answer, because I need the cash.
Mm.
I need to buy my house. I'm asset poor. I'm asset rich, but cash poor. I want to go on fucking holidays in the Maldives. I want to be able to rent a yacht for $150,000 for a week with my family. All that are good answers, because that's the language they understand. These people understand money. So they understand that I want cash is a valid answer. So like they're going to evaluate, are you going to leave? And they're also going to evaluate what happened if he leaves. Like, okay, let's say the guy is gonna, what happened if he, stupid things, like I never had a life insurance my whole life. The first thing they made me size is a 10 million life insurance to the company. If I die, the company gets 10 million cash. Give them a little leeway to find a better CEO.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. So yeah, they think of everything. You don't. So like, that's why you have to get prepared.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's risk for them, isn't it? They're like, you know, investing a lot of money. Yeah. And it's a, so as we're, I guess, we've actually like explored a fair bit there, I think, Alexis, but I said at the start of the podcast, I'd ask you for a quote, and we've said on other podcasts, it doesn't have to relate specifically to what we're talking about. It could be something that you like to feel, but is relevant. But what have you got? What have you got for us?
Okay, I got a quote actually from me. That sounds, does that work?
Yeah.
I have a quote that I ask all my clients to put as a print screen or to print it, put it in their office. It's do not confuse what's urgent with what's important. That's if you have to summarize what I do in one sentence, is this one. Like the biggest way CEOs fail is by confusing what's urgent with what's important. Like you have an unhappy client that's urgent, but that's not important. Mm. What's important is where are you going? What's your plan? What's your goal? And so that's my quote. Does that work?
That sounds great. That's a good one. Yeah, actually, that's about priorities. That actually ties in really well to, you know, the general message, I think, that you brought across. Like it comes across to me as like a really good mix of being very pragmatic, which you obviously have to be. And there's a lot of like an understanding, which I can only imagine, like there's a lot of sort of nuances, money, management, people, you know, all these things that sort of come together. There's a fair level of sophistication there to bring all those things, like to steer the ship. Like I think you say, like to steer the ship in the right sort of way for like, you know, a successful exit for somebody, which ultimately like it's about achieving a goal and everyone's on the same page, right? You know, and then you get to that point and you do everything the right way with the plan. But yeah, I think it's a fantastic sort of message. And so if people are listening to this and they want to find out more about you, where do they go online? We'll have a link to the
LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn, use my name. It's easy. I'm easy to find. I'm lucky enough to have a name that's pretty uncommon. So yes. Find me on LinkedIn.
I always
answer to messages on LinkedIn.
Yeah. And you've got a website too, right?
Yeah, I do have a website, but it's like I'm better at advising than designing websites. Let's keep it that way.
Well, that's probably, I'm probably better at designing websites than advising. Well, I'm certainly not in a private equity, maybe advising other things. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm actually now, my next project is, so with the book, I help lots of people. with my consulting, I help a very small number of people, but I talk a lot with people who are in a situation like they could use my help, but they cannot afford my help yet. All your 1 million companies, right? Mm-hmm. And they cannot afford to pay me. And to be honest, not only they cannot afford, but they don't have the mental availability to do what I tell them to do. So I'm trying to devise something that would help these people, like some kind of cohort-based, something like that, to help the 1 million people, because there's lots of them, and lots of them in social media stuff and in things that, like, they really would benefit from a bit of a methodology.
And they're going to be the other people who might be the next people, the next sort of step up, right? Yeah, at sort of some point.
Maybe. I think they might have missed that boat already.
Oh, sure.
I think I think the guys who's going to be the next one are going to be the AI guys.
Yeah.
But maybe some of them will, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. Thanks so much, Alexis. Really, really interesting. And I really hope people listening, get something out of this conversation. I think there's a lot of, things for people to think about. And you got any parting words for us?
Just don't be scared.
Don't be scared. I like it. It's nice. Thank you. Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening again to the Grow Your Business podcast. And we'll see you again soon. Say goodbye to everyone, Alexis.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone. See ya.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.